So we're going to hear today from Glenn Thorne Larson Jr. First, I'm going to tell you just a little bit about Glenn. He has a keen interest in the study of early restoration theology and leadership. He has presented papers on the Missouri establishment of Zion, the law of stewardship and consecration in the Deseret Telegraph, the Mormon Battalion, Canadian colonization. He has a keen interest in Joseph F. Smith, whom he calls the father of modern Mormonism. Currently, he is working on a book about former General Leaf Society President Barbara B. and her involvement in equal rights and movement. He is a longtime member of the Mormon History Association and the John Whitmer Historical Association, which he was just telling me about. We are also going to be hearing from Lori Pierce. Lori has an MBA from BYU and is currently the treasurer of a nonprofit that she started in Mississippi. She also teaches French, German, and Latin, and that is to gifted high schoolers in Mississippi. So just a few session reminders. Please remember to silence your cell phones. I need to do that myself. Also, if you have a chance to go downstairs and look at the book sales, there are a lot of books that are for sale today, and part of those proceeds will go back to Sunstone, and we all want to support this cause. And we will go ahead and get started.
Thank you very much for coming. If you can't hear me, raise your hand. And I'm still trying to ride the bicycle between the slides and the presentation, so if I get off a little bit, forgive me, but let's move right ahead. My premise is that as the Latter-day Saints continue to grow, it actually cannot grow any larger than a congregation, which is between 350 and 600 members. They don't like to get wards too big. And we are striving for inclusion and working diligently and creative. And we need to work across the bridge with the lay leadership of the congregation. And most problems can best be resolved at the local level and utilizing the council approach. That's what I think we should work on. And the obsolete hierarchical leadership style is calling for a return to the genesis of Mormonism, where it's a caring individual striving for a disciple that reach out to others that have needs. And I identify two of the greatest problems facing the church is rapid growth and cultural diversity and doctrinal unity. And so the church has been, and it's emerging out of a hierarchical, top-down, presiding, authority-driven leadership style, which is obsolete. And the hierarchical leadership style is being replaced and working on to be more collaborative and in a team environment. And this places greater autonomy at the ward level for the bishop and his team to carry out the basic missions of the church, which is to care for the needy, proclaim the gospel, missionary work, redeem the dead, temple, and perfect the saints, teaching and mentoring. And so each bishop across the church, we have 30,000 of them, have their own past generational leadership experience, and they're all trying to seek to build Zion in a contemporary congregation. And so the ward council is focused on accomplishing the work. Now, it shifted from the priestly executive committee, which was male-dominated. And so we want to have each area in the ward council to take ownership to solving their individual problems. And we want the women of the church to be invited and feel included in solving these problems and to become what the new term today is, stakeholders. And so we see a lot of progress, particularly in meeting the needs. As you know, when we talk about needs, I love to refer to Maslow because to me he had the best model to explain basic challenges that we face, which is you know, meeting our basic food and moving up so that we can realize our dreams and potential. And so I like that in context. And so I'd like to welcome you to a flat church. Now, as I said, the word council, you know, is predominantly male, but with the Relief Society in the primary and the young women and the Relief Society, we are now seeing a greater inclusion of our women in the church in helping in the council process. And so we need the home teachers and the visiting teachers and the ward council to work together. And our main focus is to work towards resolving the individual temporal and spiritual self-reliance of all people. And so, after all personal and extended family resources are exhausted, the Ward Council is charged to direct individual members to utilize established community and church resources. And so, we see good things happening with the missionary program of recent, where 29% of all the missionaries are sisters. And so they're the center of our missionary program. And they have a great voice in improving process and reaching needs and identifying problems and how we can work collaboratively. And so I picked up the theme of flat because of Thomas Friedman, who wrote The World is Flat. And he talks about the world constantly getting more flat. And so in his book, it's rather lengthy, written in 2004, he talks about globalization 1.0, which began when Columbus sailed the ocean blue in 1492, is when the world, the old and the new world, got connected. Before then, it was, you know, we didn't know what was on the other side of the world. And so this trade began starting in globalization 2.0 from about 1800 to 2000. But now we're entering into a new phase of 3.0 where, you know, basically I can be in one place and another person can be in Skype and they can be able to communicate with each other. You know, all the technological barriers, you know, pretty much have been removed, and as you know, we can communicate and talk and accomplish a lot of things. And so I use the example of being in talking to someone in Bangkok, which is 8,147 miles away from Salt Lake, and we can collaborate and we can work towards solving problems. And so really, space doesn't, the work at for place today is essentially on your iPhone. You can be anywhere and do work. And so the boundary between, unfortunately, between fun and play is evaporating. And so we have to use our time cautiously. And so so basically, it's the ward that can be best to solve problems. And it's projected that by 2020 that we could have as many as 17 million members of the church. And so, quoting Elder Packer of the Council of the Twelve, he said, "The church is no bigger than a congregation. Everything is there that is essential to carry out the programs." And so it's a big challenge for the lay leadership to use their stewardship. And so I call the congregation as a miniature of the world and what its people are all seeking to do, which is to yearn for Zion. And so as we get away from the ward, the eyes through state leaders and area authorities and Salt Lake headquarters, you know, gets murky. And so we really need to focus those lens at the ward level through the ward council to be able to solve our problem, because they're the ones that are closest to the problem. And so we've got to do anything we can to marshal our support to them. And so it really, when we sit in the council, a lot of it depends on our perspective. And that reminds me of the woman who went to, she's from Boston and she went to San Francisco. And she came home and she was asked by a friend how much she liked it. And she said, well, not very much. It's too far from the ocean. And so it all depends upon our perspective and our predisposition that's in our heads and how we work together collaboratively. And sometimes we can have faulty assumptions. And so we have to work on that. And so it's through the council that we recognize and appreciate diversity. And we can begin to build a gospel-centered lifestyle. And so, I don't need to go into a lot of detail, but as you know, one-third of all of our children are born in the United States to unmarried parents, compared to 6% in 1960. I think currently about 22% of all children are living with their biological parents. That's just the situation of where we're at. These numbers spike even further with Hispanics and African Americans. And so our investment in working with people in the church is going to pay high dividends because we're dealing with human capital. And at no time do we bring out the best of people when we invest ourselves in other people's. And so the volunteerism of the United States is so important because they have a great influence. And it's through the religious channels that most of the volunteering in the United States occurs. This is a very important point to keep in mind. We do get volunteering from other things, and I want to minimize the dads that go out on the ball field. But, that is very centered in some ways. And I'm sure they're doing good things for those with their sons and the boys. But it's within the church that we begin to add more, to ourselves. And so another concern is that emerging adulthoods, which has been termed between 18 and 26-year-olds, often don't feel an obligation to help each other and are much likely to help others and are more and less likely to volunteer for relative older adults. So that's a disturbing trend that concerns us. And so another thing that happens that's very fundamental is having healthy families are essential because they directly impact human, moral, and social capital, and therefore they impact resource use and economic activities and economic structures. And so our rate of return is always going up when we invest in people, and it never can decline, because how can you put a price on ignorance? And so it's so important to invest in people, and so within the council process and getting others engaged. And so I go into my paper a great deal about volunteerism, which I know we don't have a lot of time for that, but just to say that volunteerism in the United States is very extensive. It's almost equivalent to the size and economy of New Zealand, which has about 4.5 million people, and as one volunteers within the religious setting, they come through with a greater intensity for service and can connect themselves, as you know, with the laboratory versus the Word. But most people go to church today to hear the Word and have their faith strengthened. They really don't go there to serve, but that does come secondary over time. And so my premise is sometimes we have to give up something that's good for something better. And so we are, you know, have lots of good choices to make with our time, and so we have to be wise in how we choose that. And so it's within the church, if we work together in the council process, that we reduce the challenge the leadership has in caring, that carries by merely asking someone to serve. Sometimes people won't serve. You know, when you ask for volunteers, you won't get any. But if you specifically ask someone to do something, then you can probably get a yes, or maybe a no. But I do believe that people, if asked, will respond. And so, I'm not trying to make a big thing about Latter-day Saints. You know, not enough good could be said all day about the good that they do in serving. And so I went to a study that was taken between different religious groups, and, you know, the Latter-day Saints seem to come out on the top. Currently, most adults are spending, you know, that are active, about 5 hours a week or 1 hour a day serving. And so this is good. And so we just need to get others to serve along that. And as you know, there's been a lot of welfare reform, and most of the churches are having to pick up that slack. And as you know, most of the social organizations are struggling, and they need volunteers. But the challenge is the volunteer that comes into the system, you know, today is looking not just for free labor or just to give their time. They want to be included and have something significant when they come to volunteer. They want to feel ownership into solving the problems. And so this is something as we utilize people's talents. You know, most of the people that do contribute today, you know, are very educated, and they have a brain and they can think. And so it's important that we give them an opportunity. And so, you know, there's been a lot of efforts to cut federal dollars. It seems like maybe we get the appearance that we cut here, but fund over here. But as you know, I don't think the government can do as well as we who care. And so it's important for all of these service organizations. They struggle with having this balance. And so they're turning to these faith-based organizations, and they're making a big impact because they know the people better, and they can meet their needs. And so this is a very important area. The focus of the Ward Council should not be, you know, discussing all of the different activities that are coming up and spending a lot of time on the calendaring, and, you know, that should just all be on paper and emailable. But we want to spend this precious time, which is probably an hour once a month. We'd like to get a couple more hours out of a month, but at least a month, once, they come together, and their focus should be on dealing with people. And it's not that we're gossiping about people. We are trying to identify areas where we can help them out. And, you know, we don't want to lift that responsibility from them, because any time you take someone's problems away from them, then they don't have any ownership, they're not a stakeholder in solving that. And so we want to work together collaboratively and helping to help them solve their problem. There are resources, as I mentioned, with the storehouse, and our goal there is to help them become more self-sufficient. And so another trend, you know, that is I call them maybe this is a bad term, it was on the fly that I came up with this term, I call them the techno-teens, and between the ages of 11 and 18. And, you know, they've never lived in a world without the internet. My goodness. And so, as you know, when you go to church today,
And a lot of places, people don't look at you. They're looking at their iPhone. And you know, I was with one bishop not too long ago, and he said I was in my ward council, and I was talking to the ward council, and not one were looking at me. They were all looking at their iPhone. And so it's all right. But, you know, this is a new generation that's emerging, that the millennials, which are between the ages of 19 and 37, and baby boomers between 51 and 79, that we are transferring these values. And so this concerns us. And so what values, I ask, will be, will we leave with the rising generation? And as you know, this is a crude example of a building that had a fire, a church. And so if we do not instill these values, you know, through the council process, and it can only be done at the ward level, then we're not going to make traction. And so I'm calling upon the youth of the church and all of us to make shared sacrifices. And like we said, giving up something good for something better. And it doesn't come easy, as you know. It has to come from the heart and a desire to want to be a better person. So the challenge today, the second challenge, as I said, is to have a right balance between cultural diversity and doctrinal unity. When you're rolling out a worldwide church across, you know, so many different cultures, it is mind-boggling. And what one word means to you in America may not mean the same in Kosovo. And so, you know, when we talk about family, and which is fundamental to anything in the world that goes on, you know, that now we're talking about things that are important. And so, I love what C.S. Lewis said. There are no ordinary people. You have never talked to a mere mortal. Nations, cultures, arts, civilizations, these are mortal, and their life is to ours as the life of a gnat. But it is immortals whom we joke with, work with, marry, snub, and exploit. And so that is something that I think that we could all, you know, think about. I just want to let you know that everything we do is, as President Hinckley has said, is about people. And people always come before programs. And so we must engage ourselves. And so as God's chosen people, we seek to foster engagement one-on-one in a flat church that seeks to be engaged in bringing the best out of God's children wherever found in the world. Thank you.
Thanks, Glenn. Now I'm to respond. And looking at this presentation, for me, I need to put it where I am. I'm thinking about the way that I interact with the church hierarchy as a member of the church. And it was mentioned in my bio, I live in Mississippi, so I'm far from Salt Lake. And so the ward is the church for us. But I was, as he talked about the history and the development of the church, I was thinking about the family home meeting that we had this week. And I can brag about that because we haven't had family home meeting in months, but we had it this week. So I can say we had family home meeting this week. You make me think we have it all the time. And my 11-year-old daughter was in charge, and I was able to give the lesson. And because, you know, Pioneer Day had just passed, and we have some pioneer heritage in my mother's side of the family, and I have an ancestor that has a really long journal that's actually in the BYU library that I have a copy of. So I was going through some of this with my children, and one of my favorite paragraphs out of it, being someone who has always lived far from the church except for the time that I went to BYU, and this paragraph starts out with this particular ancestor who's never been famous. You've never heard of him in church history, probably. But he said, Martin Harris spent the night at my house last night, and when we got up this morning, we went over to Joseph's house, and Emma was making breakfast for Joseph and Oliver, and they were discussing the revelation that they had just received and written down and noted about which page in the Doctrine and Covenants it was. And as I was reading and telling these stories to my children, my 11-year-old just about came unglued, and she was like, our family knew Brigham Young, Joseph Smith and Oliver Cowdery. And I said, yes, it was this small town in Kirtland, Ohio. They all knew each other. And yes, our ancestors knew all of those people. And then you bring it to today, where we, you know, my children know these people as pictures on the wall or in a magazine, or, you know, people who show up on TV. And here's my experience right now with the church hierarchy that I would love to disassemble. And I will explain to you why in this example. I serve as the secretary in the primary right now. And our primary in our building occupies the back of the gym. That's our primary room. Because when the building was built, our primary room became the family history center, because the primary was almost non-existent in this particular ward. Our primary now has 40 to 50 children in it. And our gym has recently been changed from a carpet to a wood floor. So you can imagine 40 to 50 children in a room with a wood floor where you can't put up any permanent pictures, and you're supposed to try and create a reverent environment for these children. Yes, you all understand my dilemma, right? And I was primary president 11 years ago, and I tried to get the primary room changed then when it was carpeted, and we didn't even have the wood problem. Every primary president since has tried to get someone to swap rooms with us. No one will give up their room. You know, this territorial thing that we do in the church. Well, we have finally, the family history centers have become so pared down now that everything has gone electronic, that our family history center is literally a computer room. And there are a few files that have stuff that nobody's ever going to look at anymore. The microphone readers have been taken out, and it's this big open room that stays locked every Sunday morning. Except when I tell the bishopric to go in and unlock it, turn the air conditioning on, because it runs our primary rooms, because that's the way it's set up. So I have brought this up a number of times. So keep in mind, I'm still only the primary secretary. So think about how many levels of management go through me. We need to move into the Family History Center. And I can get their attention, and they, yes, we agree with you, that would be a really good idea. But it's not up to us, because we don't own the Family History Center. That's up, that has to go through, it's not even at the state level, it's the physical facilities group. That's a regional organization that has to decide if the bishopric could move any furniture in that room and let the primary use it. And I was having a discussion with my bishop about it. And the only reason I was able to have this discussion is because he and I are friends. Because normally the primary secretary and the bishop don't have a discussion, because that's not built into the hierarchy. And and he explained to me that the church is emphasizing nice family history centers. They want them to be inviting. They want a nice table and chairs. And that's the direction that's coming to him from Salt Lake. And I said, you know what, Bishop, that's a wonderful idea. And I can see that in the absence of anything else, that in Salt Lake, they would think that's a good use of that particular part of the building. But in our ward, it's coming at the expense of the children. And that's not good. That's it doesn't work that way. But this hierarchical organization where you have, not only do I have to convince the primary president to push, but she has to convince the bishopric to push, and the state presidency, and the regional building people, who then probably have to go to Salt Lake to get permission to unlock a room and move furniture and let the primary kids sit in there and let us have some permanent pictures. So I would love to see a flatter church. I would love to see more local control. One of the other things that I have found myself running up against as a fence or a wall, really, I run a local nonprofit, I sit on the board. I'm the treasurer, so I run all the finances. And this happens to be a choral association. So it's artsy and it's fun, and we do that. But I also live in Mississippi, where there is a great need for services. The town I live in, while it's not the poorest, I don't live in the Delta of Mississippi, which is the poorest part of the United States. It's still pretty darn poor. 90% of the students that attend public schools get free and reduced price lunches. And so there are lots of organizations in town that help support those needs. Soup kitchens, lunches that are served during the summer for kids, boys and girls clubs, lots of other activities. And our ward rarely participates in those community-sponsored activities. And it is primarily for one reason. Because all we can provide is manpower, which is useful, and manpower is great, But we have a lot of families with young kids. It's very difficult to get the parents away. But what they really need is some funds. A soup kitchen needs money to buy food. Or, you know, an after-school program needs money to give the students some school supplies that they can take back to school. So while the manpower is wonderful, and that's what the church emphasizes to do, getting at those funds is nearly impossible. My husband's the ward clerk, and he sees the amount of money that comes through the ward every single day. And except for managing some fast offering funds that would go to individuals, we can't touch that money. We have no control over how it gets used. We can't decide that there's a good organization here. Now, there is a conduit to go through humanitarian services and fill out a form, and it's a little bit complicated. But I would love to see more flat that way. More, my grandfather, I just thought of this. My grandfather was an old Baptist when he married my grandmother, and she managed to get him to convert to the Mormon Church. And he was a strong supporter of that little bitty branch in just north of Orlando, Florida, so many, many years ago. But they never went to the temple. Because even though my grandfather, devoted, I don't even know what percentage of his income to the local church. It was more than 10% that he paid there. I don't know the actual numbers. But he knew that if he put the money he donated in the tithing column, that it was going to go to Salt Lake. But if he put it in the budget column, it was going to stay there locally and they could use it. As an old Baptist, he did not want his money going to Salt Lake. He wanted it right there in Leesburg, Florida. So he was denied a temple recommend for I don't know how many years until they finally had a branch president who convinced him it was okay if you put that money in the tithing column and then I can give you a temple recommend and, you know, we are okay here. But those are the kind of things when looking at it personally, that's what, when you say flat church, those are the things that come to mind to me. So that's my contribution. Thank you.
We'd like to have questions or comments if you have them. We request that you use that microphone. These are being recorded, and we'd like to have the questions being recorded as well so that the people listening to the answers know the question that was asked. So we have until 4:45.
Oh, yeah, just
up to the mic.
Sorry.
I so identify with everything you said because it's a constant problem, this hierarchical not being able to get. I've always said if you are a woman who has a fantastic idea for something, whatever it is, and that she feels would really help the ward or the children, if she can't convince her bishop that it's a great idea, it's dead in the water. And that was one of the things that frustrated me the most in the years that I was really heavy into leadership. And I honestly, I don't know what would have to happen for it to change. Do you have an idea? Do you have an idea of how we can convince the people in the big tall building that it should be different?
As you know, it takes time to unfreeze old behavior, establish new contacts, and then refreeze that new behavior. And, you know, we have to be patient. There's a lot of things pressing leaders of the church at the local level. For some of you who have been in these different leadership roles, I don't need to go into ad nauseam the competing forces that are there. But I do believe that if we're prayerful and put it on the agenda, continue to work it. And as long as we're focused on people, and then things will work out. And so we just have to be patient. I mean, things don't change. Yes.
What about going to the state president?
Well, yeah. As you know, that doesn't always bode well with the local leaders going above them. But, I mean, you can always, when you come in for your temple recommend, if the president said, do you have anything we could do to improve, there's your segue. I generally, you know, always drop one I try to keep it to one or two things. It may be, it doesn't happen overnight. You know, in my particular ward, I'm a ward mission leader, and I work in a congregation down in the 33rd South and 3rd East, and we've got a lot of challenges there. And so I'm trying to get home teachers and trying to get membership records updated, and so we had to be patient. Any other discussions?
I love the Mormon people, and I know there's so many with good intentions, but the last thing, I have seen nothing but really ugly stuff come out of correlation meeting. It's a place where people gossip. It comes down through the whole world and ward. The most personal, tragic circumstances are repeated third hand, fourth hand. People don't want to go to church anymore. We will keep anything that happens in our house absolutely away from the brothers and sisters who mean well and usually break hearts. And the thought of even spending more time, I mean, our bishop knows that we better never come up in a correlation meeting. We've seen too many others whose lives have been so desperately hurt. And I think we need to be more conscious of people's privacy, need for confidentiality. Yes. And there's things you share with your bishop that you don't want the primary president to know. Especially when it's about your children, it can be debilitating. And I think it's an ugly, awful, awful, invasive system.
Thank you.
I just want to ask, is how do you think that a regular member of the church who has good ideas about how things can be run better locally is perceived by leadership, especially in the higher levels of the church? Are they perceived as being troublemakers, or are they actually listened to? What forum do we have as regular members of the church to have our voices heard by those who make the hierarchical decisions that filter down to us? What's missing? Do you understand
yes.
that process?
Yes.
Does
anyone have any insights?
Can I speak to that?
Please.
Because I happen to be a troublemaker, and I have lots of suggestions, but I have never taken seriously. Sometimes at the ward level, they will listen to me because they know me. They're there with me every week. They see the commitment that I have. They will do what they can. At least they listen to me about the primary room. They haven't changed anything. They're not moving, but they're listening. But if I happen to go to the state presidency with a suggestion or a concern, literally I get no response. None whatsoever. And anything above that, well, worse.
It's always a challenge in, you know, working with people. And I think if we're sincere, and what I've tried to do is the most important area is missionary work and reaching out and visiting people. And so I spent, you know, the last 15, 20 years, you know, just going out and visiting people. And I just have to just keep moving on, you know, try to direct them to, if they have a problem, you know, to other leaders within the ward. And, you know, you just cannot get yourself in a go-between on how leaders should reach out to this person or that person. And so we listen to them, and probably that's the best thing we can do is listen. And then there'll be a timing where problems will be resolved. And I have seen lots of miracles, so we have to look for those tender mercies, you know, that come through. And, you know, if we're sincere, we have the right spirit. You know, this church is run by, you know, the leaders and the spirit. And so we have to let them, you know, feel that. And it may take time. Sometimes a new leader comes in with a whole different perspective, and, you know, then we make traction in that area.
My question is, do you do you have a sense, I mean, you're making a call for a new style of organization and leadership, if I understand you correctly. My experience over the last 40 years is that things are, by and large, getting more centralized, that people are worried about losing control as the church expands, as more influence is coming from society, the natural organizational response is to clamp down. Do you see actual signs that that's changing? I mean, in the workplace, it's changed enormously, right? We really value diversity. I mean, it's not just a slogan, it's not a legal requirement, it actually helps. And devolving responsibility down is at least wherever I've worked, that's a good notion. Is that happening, or
of course
are we still resisting it?
It's happening at different levels in different wards. As you know, every ward has had its own process in brokering those issues. And so I think the best thing to do is to do your best in whatever calling you have and assign them. And then you just have to let the leadership go. And that doesn't make for happiness every second, but I think you can take the contempt of that you've done your best.
And yeah, well, that's great for me, but not for everybody else's experience. And also, it's quite frustrating. But I want you to respond, but I also want to mention the problem with the devolution of responsibility down is the skill level of the people and the gossiping or whatever the problems are when people actually have power.
Well, and
what I wanted to say in response to that, having watched several priesthood leaders and watching my father and my brothers, what we have some sort of a cultural issue. I do see some things, I can say, like music, for instance. The handbook leaves that up to the bishop, what's appropriate in sacrament meeting. So, and I think they are trying somewhat to give more local control on some things, but you're right, there's a lot of centralized control. But what we are fighting is a culture of looking to our leaders to tell us what to do. And so even though they are giving bishops some leeway in making some of these decisions, the bishops are not running with it. My current bishop, for instance, I will tell you, he and I are friends. We were friends before he was called as bishop. He and his wife and I are probably the only people in the ward who ever vote Democrat. So we have a good relationship. He supported me when I went to conference in October with ordained women. He came to me and told me specifically that he had read what I wrote online. He supported it. He wished me well. He hoped something would change. But he told me, I'm not doing anything differently until my state president tells me to do so. That is the problem, is when we have people that are continually looking to the person above them to give them every direction and tell them everything to do, then we have this problem that we run into.
I don't like to speak like this, but I feel like part of this, I'm a convert. And
I hear.
Oh, sorry. I feel like part of this is cultural and part of this is doctrine. Because where I'm from in Texas, we don't do that. We had a problem with red ants, which you probably don't know about. They're horrible. They bite children.
Yeah.
And I mentioned it. No one fixed it. I just had the exterminator come out and take care of it because it was biting our children. I found out later that I should have gone through
right.
channels and gone up to the physical plant.
You need to get forgiveness.
You know, I didn't know any better. I did it. And in your circumstance, I know exactly what you're talking about. I've been primary president many, many times. And we just do it.
Well,
we just find someone who's got the key that's going to let us use that key, and we just move on in.
I never gave up my church key when I was primary president
exactly.
8 years ago.
I got a library key, too.
My experience has been also to go from bishop to state president, and when that didn't work, I sent a letter to the church, and in this particular case, it was had to do with a care center where I said that the sacrament bread should be, and the water, it was unsanitary. I said, these handicapped people are massaging the bread and sticking their fingers in all the cups, so shouldn't we spread the cups apart? And shouldn't we spread the bread apart? Just put one piece of bread on the other side of the tray, and so on. And to make a long story short, apparently the church says, well, it's up to the ward, the individual situation, and no one size doesn't fit all. But that is another route, too, in my opinion, is if we don't like what the bishop or stake president, if they haven't done anything, and that was the issue in my case, they said, well, the Lord can heal people and not let the germs hurt people. But I says, the Lord expects us to do our part, and part of our part is to be sanitary. But you can try that as well, as well as prayer. And in that chain of command, some people bring them up these issues to their home teachers and to their relief society president, to others who go to the ward council. But when you're a member of the ward council like you are, I like her approach. Just go ahead and do it. That's what we did. We said, when my wife and I were in charge, we said, this is the way we're going to do it. We haven't heard that we should, but that we're going to be sanitary.
If you're not told, you can't.
And now one of my assignments is social chairman of the high priest group. Has anybody heard of that position before?
Does that mean you keep them awake?
And, so I say, now, being used to this hierarchical system, what do you want us to do? It's up to you. You're the social chairman, so I'll come up with sometimes two or three ideas and say, which one do you like? It's up to you. That's your calling. So I think they're gradually getting more flatlined.
So you see some thumbing there. Good. Thank you. Well, thank you so much. Is there anything more?
I think I'm good.
You know, for your comments. I think we have to be patient with the process. All organizations are struggling with this. Particularly volunteer organizations. And so sometimes this is the laboratory experience where we get tested and we get to see how we can work together. But thank you so much for coming to the session.